The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm Denver Frederick, and let me tell you what we have lined up for you this evening. The New School, which includes the Parsons School of Design, and the New School for Social Research, is celebrating its centennial anniversary this year. And with us will be David Van Zandt, the president of the New School, who will share with us their founding story.
It's a story of a number of faculty from Columbia University were very upset and concerned about the lack of free intellectual debate there. In fact, at the time, there had been a requirement by the president that all faculty sign a loyalty pledge. This is the time of the Red Scare, the first wave of fear about communism. They came down and said, we want to found an institution that's basically free thought, open discussion of all political perspectives.
And then I will be speaking with Rachel Doyle, the founder and CEO of Glamour Gals, a great idea that has sparked intergenerational connection.
This idea of going into a local senior home, spending time with the women there, and more specifically, giving them a beauty makeover. The beauty makeovers I used to do with my girlfriends in my bedroom. Maybe not the Kevin O'Quan, let's shellac the face, but it was this idea of bringing that same essence of how you feel when someone dotes on you and someone compliments you.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, March 24th. Finland has been crowned the happiest country in the world for the second year in a row, leading a top 10 that is made up of five Nordic nations. The U.S. placed 19th, its lowest rating ever. The least happiest, South Sudan. Spearheaded by snack bar company Kind, food scientists are asking the government to regulate foods that say things like high in protein to mask the fact that they're also high in sugar. Higher education fundraisers are concerned that the Varsity Blues college admissions scandal could spark a wave of efforts to curtail tax breaks for giving to universities, which would have a huge impact on their revenue. South Africa, home to the world's largest population of people living with HIV, shocked health officials by revealing a 44% decline in new infections since 2012. Some 2.3 million people in the United States are currently being held in jail, prison, or a correctional facility, the equivalent of 698 per 100,000 residents, a report from the Prison Policy Initiative finds. And finally, the Arbor Day Foundation has announced the launch of the Time for Trees Initiative, a commitment to plant 100 million trees in forests and communities worldwide by 2022, the 150th anniversary of Arbor Day. And that is a Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with David Van Zandt from the New School right after this.
Do you remember your first job? Year Up is empowering low-income young adults with the skills and experience to get their first job. 85% of alumni are employed or in school within 4 months of graduation. Support opportunity for all. Visit yearup.org.
If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile?
In a very challenging landscape for higher education, there are certain institutions that seem just right for the present moment. One of those would be the New School, located right here in Manhattan, and who are celebrating their centennial anniversary this year. And it's a great pleasure to have with us tonight the president of the New School, David Van Zandt. Good evening, David.
Good evening.
And welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you, Denver. Pleased to be here.
Let's begin at the beginning. As I just mentioned, the New School was founded 100 years ago in 1919. What is the founding story of the institution?
It's a great story. It's a very New York story. It's a story of a number of faculty from Columbia University were very upset and concerned about the lack of free intellectual debate there. In fact, at the time, there had been a requirement by the president that all faculty sign a loyalty pledge. This is the time of the Red Scare, the first wave of fear about communism. They came down and said, we want to found an institution that's basically free thought, open discussion of all political perspectives and likewise and otherwise. And we wanted to. We also don't want it to be hemmed in by a lot of the conservative structures that a place like Columbia or other significant mm-hmm. universities have. So we want no buildings. We want no full-time faculty, and we don't want to have an endowment. So, and so they started offering offering non-degree, just basically lectures at night mm-hmm. to people in the Greenwich Village and in surrounding community. They wanted to be open access in the sense of anybody could come. And if you look at some photos of those old lectures going on, it was really a mixed crowd and probably a lot of Eastern European immigrants, Jewish, otherwise, a lot of women. Mm-hmm. Those audiences tended to be half women. And this was a group that was educated either in the home country or to a certain level here, you know, who just higher education wasn't an option for them. And so that's really how with that idea of free expression or at least open dialogue and debate.
Yeah, it almost sounds like the start of continuing education in some ways.
Well, that's exactly right. That's where a lot of it started in a particular form. Yep.
Yeah. As part of the rich history of the New School would be the University in Exile, which has now evolved into the New School for Social Research. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, it was almost a complete turnaround for the New School because it had started as this place with no degrees, no structures mm-hmm. or anything, and just offering courses. In the early 1930s, Alvin Johnson, my predecessor, the first director president of the university, decided as Nazis began to move in Europe that he would try to bring in or rescue as many scholars as he could from Germany and also some from Austria and mm-hmm. later from France. And he, with the help of the Rockefeller Foundation and scholars, the Scholars Rescue Fund, began to bring in large numbers of those academics. They were social science academics for the most part. He was he was an economist himself, and he focused on that particular part of academia. And he built up over the years a faculty. It was called the graduate faculty, which there was probably 150 people came through. At any one time, there may have been 30 or so people on the faculty. And they began offering degrees, PhDs, in fact. They moved from nothing to offering PhDs.
Zero to 60.
I always joke, and today if I tried to make a radical move like that, I'd have my head handed to me. But that's he was quite the innovator and entrepreneur.
Yeah, some people may not realize, David, that the New School is comprised of five colleges. What would those be?
Well, great. It's evolved over time, but today what we have is the biggest part of what we are is Parsons, mm-hmm. the School of Design. Which has some 5,500 to 6,000 students in it. And it offers, bachelor's through a master's degree. Another college is Eugene Lang College, which is a liberal arts college. It's about 1,600 students in it right now. I'm proud to say my wife teaches in that uh-huh. in that college. A third is the New School for Social Research. Which is sort of what the University in Exile was.
Right.
So it's a social science graduate school, maybe 800 students in it or so. It offers masters and PhDs. Mm-hmm. Fourth is the College of Performing Arts. Now that's a reasonably new college, formed during my time. It was put together from our drama program, our master's in drama program, our jazz program, and as well as Manus, the conservatory. Many people will know the name Manus.
Most
people don't know as part of the New School. It used to be, when I started, it used to be uptown on the west side. We brought it down, mm-hmm. And we integrated the entire campus downtown. The fifth school is, we call it the Schools of Public Engagement. It's a group of different, usually master's level program, but it also has our continuing, our adult bachelor's program for people who've, gone to school, some dropped out, went to work, coming back and trying to get their degree. We have a set of management degrees. We have a media studies, a media management program. We even have teaching English as a foreign language.
Quite the enterprise, I might say. Yeah. Who are some of the graduates or people who have passed through the New School since it was founded 100 years ago?
Well, for our centennial, it's been remarkable. We went back and looked at all the people who have gone through. We've got a great video that actually shows many of them. It ranges. Some of our founders were John Dewey, Charles mm-hmm. Beard, very famous. Into the 20s, we had people like Henry Cowell, Aaron Copland, composers, major composers. Martha Graham was there for a while. Harry Belafonte took classes there. It goes John Cage, the very creative musician, composer of the 50s, was there as well. So you go back, there's a long list of different people who were at the New School. There were some stars from the academic world as well in the social sciences. Leo Strauss, who's at University of Chicago, ended up at University of Chicago, started with us. Claude Levi-Strauss, I'm an anthropologist or sociologist, so I knew that name.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
These are famous names out of academics.
Yeah, it's quite an impressive list. It's been said by you and others, and you kind of alluded to it before, that the New School is unbound by the constraints of traditional university. Speak to that a little bit and how it works to your advantage in the world of today.
I think from the history I just described, you can see it was intentionally unbound mm-hmm. right from the beginning. And today, while we offer degrees like other universities and have to be accredited and approved by the state of New York,
yep.
I think we have degrees of freedom in the sense that it's always been a very mobile place where people coming in and out. We have a large number of people who work in the community who may particularly teach at Parsons who will have their own business. They'll come in and teach a class. What they do is they bring a lot of the outside world in new ideas and ways of doing things differently. So there's a general – I think today it's about a culture. It's a culture of innovation. People just don't say, well, we've been doing it that way for 100 years.
Yeah,
let's
yeah.
keep doing it that way. But they're always thinking of new things. Sometimes they work. Sometimes they don't work.
Yeah.
That's the way things work. Yeah. You don't have this mindset that we have to do one thing all the time. And people are constantly raising ideas, and we're developing programs of different kinds.
Yeah, and you also seem to be a very porous institution. A lot of these institutions sort of have gates around them a little bit. But
that's
you seem to have that, that porousness where the community and the university kind of interact, and ideas are coming in and going out, and it's a flow both ways, which I think is really remarkable.
Yeah, we're porous both figuratively and as well as physically.
Yes, you are, right.
And so our new building, the University Center at 13th, 14th Street and 5th Avenue, is right on 5th Avenue. That is basically built, designed on the ground floor in particular to be open to the community,
mm-hmm.
and we run over 1,000 different programs every year that are open to the public. And we have some very loyal followers who come all the time, and other people will come and watch events episodically. Yeah.
Let me ask you, David, about one of the biggest issues facing higher education in the U.S. today,
mm-hmm.
and that is the value of higher education.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, more and more people have started to question the return on investment of a college education. What's the case today for higher education, and is it different than perhaps it was, let's say, a generation ago?
Yeah, I think we're facing a very difficult time as a society. It's not just the United States. It's the rest of the world has the same challenge. Today, a higher education, a bachelor's degree, even a master's degree, has never been more valuable at any point in history. In part because more people have them, but also more importantly because in the current economy, in the way the economy has emerged, the people who are very educated get the better jobs. The economy needs better trained, better educated people. And so higher education is just more and more valuable. Our problem, and this is where we get the complaints, is that it's very expensive to do it the way we do it. We at the New School are high touch.
Mm-hmm.
We run a residential program. It's a full-time program. We pride ourselves on students having people as faculty in their studios on a very low student-faculty ratio, and a lot of colleges try to keep a low student-faculty ratio. But that's very expensive, and costs keep going up. And if you're in Greenwich Village, one of the more costly parts of the most costly city in the world, your costs are very high. And so I think that the people are beginning to question that. And we're seeing a number of colleges around the country close.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right? And the way I look at it is that the colleges that have some strong differentiator, there's some who have very elite status, who always have a name and a big endowment. They have applications coming out the out the wazoo, so to speak. Whereas it's the sort of colleges that don't have any differentiating features are suffering, and their enrollment's suffering. My view of this today is a family who has a high school senior says, well, if you can go into one of these either elite or highly differentiated places, we'll pay for it, or we'll work as hard as we can. But you're not going to go to a second-tier school, and then then we'll pay $60,000 a year to support you just so you can live there and have a nice time. You're going to go to the local community college or state college. So you're seeing also the state systems overwhelmed with students. And that's a challenge we all face. The new school is really well positioned for that just because of what we offer. We offer to a very highly innovative education. Basically, we look at ourselves as preparing people for the creative economy. So we go out and do admissions. We're targeting a very small portion of the population. About 11% of the graduating high school seniors headed to college. We call them engaged innovators. They're people who are extremely creative, but also don't just want to make pretty things, but want to use that creativity to make the world a better place somehow. And that's
what employers need.
And that's
they say the number one thing they need is creativity.
Creativity, right. They need people who are creative in solving problems and the other thing about our students is they're going to go into careers that are there are many, many different jobs. They're going to have to be resilient. They're going to have to understand how to change with the times. The times are changing much faster than they ever did. We need to prepare students for that kind of world.
Yeah. I think also sometimes people look at the metric of how much money you make coming out of college.
Sure.
And that's maybe not the right metric because I can't tell you the number of people I know who have taken lower paying jobs because they want to do something which is going to have impact or they want to get a different kind of experience. But the metric in the narrative right now is this is what college costs,
right,
and this is how much you make coming out. And that probably is a very, very short-sighted and limited way of looking at it.
Yeah, I think it's very short-sighted. If you look at the career paths of students coming out of liberal arts colleges, what happens – for the most part, depending upon what they majored in, is they'll start out with a lower salary than maybe peers who went to a business school or more technical type of education. But over the course of their career, their salaries actually go higher, whereas those technical people are sort of – there's a ceiling at which they hit. So I think people have to look long into the future. I do think that, though, that one of our problems is it's because it's so expensive today, there are many people don't have the luxury of waiting for that time. Their families can't support them for the first few
and
years.
And they got debts.
And they have debts.
Yeah.
Right. And they need to address them. So it's partly cultural in thinking about it, but it's also some real economics behind it because, and that's the challenge we all face. And the new school started is continuing education for people who, and we are now in our next century moving back towards trying to figure out how to be more accessible to more people.
Let me bring up admission again because you mentioned that a moment ago. And you, as you know, the admission process of colleges are really under a microscope these days, perhaps the anti-discrimination suit against Harvard being the primary example. Has your admission policy changed at the new school since you took over? And if so, how?
Yeah, it's certainly changed. We have always had a very diverse population of students. And while you could always do better, I've felt that, we were doing the right things in that area to attract people. I don't know if you know, but all over a third of our undergraduates come from outside the U.S.
Right.
So we're very – which is the largest number in the country. So it's
– has that been impacted at all by the current climate?
Well, we were quite fearful of that, and we were making plans for – about 10% of our students, a little less, come from the mainland China. And so we were quite concerned about – fortunately, the last couple of years, it hasn't had that impact. It's had a very serious impact around the country.
Yeah.
I know the University of California system's lost quite a few students, foreign students coming in. For us, I think it's a couple of things. I think it's the value of the education, in particular Parsons education. It's just the elite, number one in the world. And it's second, it is New York City. And I think New York City is somewhat viewed as a haven or an island within the craziness the rest of America seems to be.
Well, many high school seniors who plan on going to college are right in the process of making the decision any moment now. What advice would you give them, and what factors do you think that they should really carefully consider, maybe some that they've overlooked, in order to make the best decision?
Right. I think probably the best thing. You get the most out of a traditional college education by being someplace where you feel comfortable, mm-hmm. where you have peers around you who you respect and even look up to. You always want somebody there who's going to push you, one of your peers. So I think it's very important to look at that in a college. What's sort of the environment like? It's tough being on the outside and going for one college visit to tell that, but I think that has a lot to do with the long-term success of going to college. In our particular case, you know, we're not for everyone. So, you know, it's a small portion of the population, but the people who are these engaged innovators, you know, we're the ideal match for them and what they want to do going forward.
Let's talk a little bit about the relationship that you have with New York City and that New York City has with you.
Yeah. Well, the New School, you know, was founded right in the heart of New York City years ago. And as I mentioned, it had opened doors in terms of who could come and take courses. So it's always been, in one sense, providing a public service to New York that the other colleges and universities, at least back then, weren't able to do or weren't willing to actually do. You know, and so over the years, we've continued that. We still have a continuing education program that's very strong. Another area where we've, I believe, contributed a lot has been in the public policy area. We have people coming in and out of city government over the years through our Milano School of Public Policy. But probably the biggest impact today is that, you know, New York City, I don't know if people know this, but New York City has more college students in it than Boston does. People think of Boston as being all made of college students, but they are a big percentage here, but we have more students here. And the other thing we have here is some, you know, very strong industries. Obviously, finance is one. But a big, very, you know, ranking right up there is the creative industry, design. It can be in media. It can be in actual design. It can be in, you know, all sorts of related areas. And, you know, we provide a lot of the talent for that industry in New York. And in an era in which higher education is only more important and employers are looking for people with higher sets of capabilities and skills, in one sense, I think that's our biggest contribution to New York City. New York City is in a great position. It needs to continue to support its higher education institutions. That's the key right now. I mean, that's the key to a city economy doing well is having strong higher education.
Yeah, that's right. And seems to me the key to any city, even New York City, is having young talent.
Exactly.
And if you can supply young talent, you are going to be very coveted and very much
And we get very excited young talent who are coming. I mean, one thing I say, we don't have as many dorms as, say, a Columbia or NYU does. Yeah. But, in fact, a lot of our students don't want to live in dorms. They want to be in the city. They want to get going. They want to be, you know, living in the city. You know, they're not going to be able to live around, you know, the school itself. Yeah, they're living all over the city. But that's the kind of mentality they have. They don't want to be sort of holed up in a dorm or a quad or a small self-contained college.
Ready to go. Absolutely.
Yep, exactly.
That's very interesting. What has given you the greatest satisfaction since you started at the New School? And what would you say has been your biggest challenge?
Yeah. I would say the biggest satisfaction has been bringing the university together. You know, it started, it was sort of cobbled together as a group of siloed programs. Mm-hmm. Parsons came in on its own back in 1970. Manus came 1990. And they really didn't interact with each other. Manus was way uptown. I mean, I went up there my first couple of weeks of on the job, and they, you know, barely knew they were in the New School. There were a couple signs, but they didn't even think of themselves that way. So I think bringing the university together, both academically and physically, has probably been the biggest achievement. And we have a vision of the well-educated student, which is a student who has a strong liberal arts foundation, knows something about management, and then has a set of skills, whether design or performing arts or something like that, that they can take out into the marketplace. And by getting particularly our undergraduates to move across the different programs, they may come in through a certain door. It may be the Parsons door. It may be the Lang door. It may be the Manus door or the Jazz door. But they end up interacting in the classes. They take the same liberal arts classes. So they have the same foundation, even if their program is less liberal arts than a 100% liberal arts student. So that's been very important. And then we buttress that by physically with the building of the University Center, we brought our Manus downtown. We brought our School of Fashion, which is in the West 40s.
Yeah.
Down to the main campus. Fashion is over 1,000 of our students out of our 10,000.
Right.
And that's a big part of our population. You know, we built the renovated, created the Performing Arts College with its own building on 13th Street. And, you know, those have been it's important to be close physically.
You're absolutely right. You know, there's a lot of highfalutin talk about breaking down silos, but physical proximity
makes
is probably
difference.
Number one. You know?
Yeah, which is hard to do in a place like New York City.
It sure
real
is.
Estate
yeah,
costs,
yeah, there's a lot of orchestration to make something like that happen.
Yeah, so we're constantly.
A lot of leases, a lot of things. You get a lot of maneuvering.
Yeah.
And the most challenging?
Most challenging. I say, you know, I think probably the most challenging has been living through this particular period of American history.
Yeah.
You know, I arrived and, you know, we had Sandy, we had Occupy Wall Street going on. We had a
right next door here.
Right, student, yeah. We had a student center. Our student study center was occupied mm-hmm. by a lot of outsiders. And then you had the presidential election, which, you know, it's just for a place like ours, particularly with a large international population, was a real shock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we certainly had many international students who were quite concerned about whether they'd be able to continue their education in the U.S. or whether maybe they shouldn't move. Some of our Canadian friends were very aggressive about trying to recruit them at the time. But dealing with that sort of very high, very hot sort of environment, and our students in particular who care a lot about the world were both concerned and engaged in that. And, I think that's one of the more difficult challenges I in particular face here in New York City. But I think the other college presidents have seen that too.
Let's face it. It's a challenge being a college president.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many issues.
Yeah.
There are so many constituencies who are vying for your time and attention. Not to mention budgets and fundraising.
Sure.
How do you prioritize, David, and how do you spend your time?
I've always tried to keep my eye on the ball of strategy. What is the institution?
Mm-hmm.
Where is it headed? What do we need to do to get it there? Lots of stuff happens every day that you have to respond to. But the key is not to lose sight on the goals that you actually – that the institution has, that you have for the institution. It's the part of the job I like the best, too,
mm-hmm.
and thinking about the future of the institution and directing it in a certain direction that makes sense from the way the world is. And it's the thing I try to keep doing all the time, even if I've got some other things that are drawing my attention away.
Yeah. Centennial anniversaries are wonderful milestone events, and it's really an occasion to appreciate the history of the institution and recommit to the founding values. Mm-hmm. At the same time, visioning ahead for the next 100 years and putting some of those plans into action. What are you doing to mark and optimize this once-in-a-lifetime occasion?
Right. Well, it's great. I mean, it's our 100th anniversary this year. We've already, at the start of the year, modified all of our websites and other sort of visual things.
I noted.
We have a series of different events happening at the school during the course of the year. For example, we just had a conference on what democracy means, which mm-hmm. seems to be a pretty fitting topic right now. The Philip Glass Ensemble just made us their residents, and they are going to do a concert with our Manus. Or actually, our Manus students are going to perform some Philip Glass's Symphony Number 3, I think, and I've forgotten when it is in a short period of time. The real key, though, is the week of October 1st to October 6th, 9th or so, when we will just be open, have a series of events, and I think, at the new school, largely in the University Center, but in other places that will celebrate both our past, but also our future. And that's really important. I think when you're doing a centennial, you need to look back to see where you were.
Sure.
What all the great accomplishments you've had. You also are looking back a bit to see what your identity is,
mm-hmm.
you know, as an institution over 100 years. You get lost in the details of day-by-day living today. What you're looking at, too, is the future. What directions the university have to go? We're making a big effort. We call it the Centennial Project to try to imagine what the new school will look like in 20, 30, 40 years, what it should look like, where we want to direct it. And the idea behind this, we have all of our, our faculty, our students, our staff, as well as alumni or others will be involved in this process. The key is to look far enough out so people aren't themselves worried about their own situation.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So you'll get much better ideas that way if you're looking far enough out. So we're looking forward to the next, you know, what are we going to do with the next century? What's the new school? What's it going to contribute?
Well, the next century is going to take money, and part of that is the New Century Campaign.
That's right.
Which is looking to raise $250 million. Give us an update on the progress of that effort.
Well, we announced the campaign on January 1st, and, mm-hmm. and thanks to some of our trustees, our alumni, many other donors, we're up to $165 million.
Good work.
So we're well on our way to that, and that is something I hope we'll finish up in the next year and a half or 2 years at most. So.
Do you like to fundraise?
Yeah, well, the part of it I really like is meeting people.
Yeah.
You know, you meet some very interesting people. You learn about their careers. That is the thing that attracts me to doing the fundraising. You know, also you get to promote the institution that you love. That in my case, you know, that I feel like I have some responsibility for directing.
Yeah.
So it's a very easy thing. It's a very easy thing to do.
Talk a little bit about the corporate culture at the new school. Is there anything that you specifically do to help shape it and influence? And what do you think makes it such a special place to work?
Yeah. Well, I think we would never call it corporate culture, by the way.
But, right, right.
but it's, you know, it's the organizational culture, and it's the people come to the news. It's amazing. I've had a couple of receptions in my home for staff and faculty who've been there, you know, hit certain milestones, 20 years, 30 years. It's amazing the number of people who have been there for a long time. Why? Because they love the mission of the new school. It's not just another job for them.
Mm-hmm.
They are there because they're dedicated to the idea of what the new school is. Now, they may not have the same idea that the current administration does at any particular point in time, but they're there on a mission, and I think that makes it a very attractive place to come. And people stay, quite a long while. It's not like we're paying, you know, we don't give out stock options and large salaries, but it's, you know, people come because they love being in that environment. And I think what I try to do myself to maintain that is to one, be present mm-hmm. as much as possible. Two is to emphasize how we treat each other, whether we're talking about service, whether we're talking about discussion, interaction, you know, treat each other with a respect and civility. You know, those are the things I try to do in order to maintain that good culture.
Yeah, it's a great way to model behavior, and others will take note
right.
and do the same.
Right, right.
Let me close with this, David. You have decided to conclude your presidency in June of next year after nearly a decade
yeah.
in this role.
Right.
As a person who likes to leave things better than they found them,
mm-hmm.
which I believe you certainly have, tell us how you've accomplished that and what you believe your legacy will have been to the new school.
Yeah, you know, I think the legacy is the main legacy is bringing the school together,
yeah.
Integrating it in a way it never was in the past. I can't claim to be the one who started that, but I certainly feel like that we have been able to really meet that goal over these last couple of years. You know, we've done it in a very difficult time. We are a tuition-based institution and certainly are always, you know, financially, you have to look at that and watch that very carefully. We don't have a big endowment. That's been the main accomplishment. One part of that, which I probably haven't mentioned as much, is giving the university an identity with the students.
Mm.
Going back to what I said about engaged innovators, you know, saying we're not for everyone. Let's get off this idea that we're just a regular college that, you know, anybody, you know, we take anybody as long as they're, you know, they have good SAT scores and good GPAs. You know, we're focused on a particular kind of individual, and I think that has two impacts. One is that we can do a better job of educating them, and we're contributing to society by educating that portion of the population. But two, we help the students themselves. These are young people who
mm-hmm.
are finding their way, trying to find their identity. If they, the label of engaged innovator or thinking of yourself in those terms is a very positive way to think about yourself and to start your career. You know, I think far too often in society, particularly in high schools, which are very traditional, you know, the kids who are very creative, who are artistic or very creative, tend to be pushed to the side.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the ones, you know, on the football team or the debate society, those sorts of things. You know, we've given those a place to come. You know, they may not be as comfortable in a more traditional place, but they are really comfortable where we are.
Yeah, well, it's good to know who you are,
yep,
and let
right.
everybody else know who you are, that's as opposed right. to try to be all things to all people, which yeah. so many institutions yeah. do. Well, David Van Zandt, the president of the New School, thanks so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website, some of the information you got there, maybe some of the centennial activities which were going to be occurring.
Yep, go right to www.newschool.edu, and you will see all of our activities posted there. You know, take a trip through the website, as you do, as you should. And I think you can get a sense of the excitement. I'm very proud of the work our people have been able to do on that website. It's a very, as you might expect from a school of creativity, it's very visually oriented.
Yeah, it's great.
Because visual communication is so important today.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating history, and you tell that all
that
there
is
as
great.
Well.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much, Dave. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been an honor.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
A simple smile can say so much. It can say thank you, please, or even I love you. Sometimes a smile can say more than words could ever express. But what if you couldn't smile? Unfortunately, that's the sad reality for so many children today. Without the help of life-saving surgery, helpless children find themselves cast aside and all alone. But it doesn't have to be this way. To learn how you can help Smile Train, the world's largest cleft charity, change the world one smile at a time, go to smiletrain.org.
If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Intergenerational conversations are so important. For seniors, where over half of those living in nursing homes will never have a visitor, as well as for young people. But how do you get these conversations started? Sometimes you need a tool, like makeup. That was the idea that launched the nonprofit organization Glamour Gals back in 2000. And it's a pleasure to have with us tonight their founder and CEO, Rachel Doyle. Good evening, Rachel, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you for having me.
A beauty makeover. What a splendid idea. You were just in high school when you started Glamour Gals. What was going on in your life then, Rachel? And how did this whole thing get going?
I think as a young person, I was always driven to service. I walked a walk. I collected cans. I was at every service event. It was just who I was. But I noticed that service wasn't necessarily connecting with others. And I thought about, at the time, maybe a little selfishly, the things that I loved. And I loved beauty, fashion, and makeup.
Mm-hmm.
And why couldn't I take the two things that I was so passionate about, the beauty, fashion, makeup, and making people smile, and combine them? And at the time, my grandmother was living in a senior home across the country, and she had passed away, and I wanted to do something to honor her. And sort of all together, it came this idea of going into a local senior home, spending time with the women there, and more specifically, giving them a beauty makeover. The beauty makeovers I used to do with my girlfriends in my bedroom, maybe not the Kevin O'Quan, let's shellac the face, but it was this idea of bringing that same essence of how you feel when someone dotes on you and someone compliments you. So in August of 1999, I had the idea.
Mm-hmm.
I walked into a local nursing home. I maybe had gone once to play my violin at 2 years ago
yeah.
during the holidays. And I pitched the idea of something called Glamour Gals, where myself and my friends would come in and give the women their beauty makeovers. And the activities director stopped me and said, who's your corporate sponsor? Who's the adult in charge? And I'm like, got out my notepad, being like, oh, yeah, sure, I got this.
Oh, yeah.
I'll get back to
it's
you.
In the car.
Yeah. I walked out those double doors, got in my mom's minivan and said, you're an adult. Will you help me out?
And what's a corporate sponsor?
And now I'm really dating myself because I actually opened up the Yellow Pages and started calling,
mm-hmm.
cold calling beauty makeup companies. In just pitching them my idea. And a local Mary Kay representative,
right.
Tony Fischler, said, you know, I love this idea. I have some extra makeup. Why don't I come to your first makeover? I'll bring the makeup. I can even give you some tips on the makeover and get you started. So in January of 2000, myself and two girls from homeroom went into the local senior home who had sent out a press release.
Mm-hmm.
Which, unbeknownst to me, the New York Times showed up along with two local newspapers.
That's a pretty nice start.
I think there was more press there than people. But, you know, as a young person starting something, I just I remembered the vision of why I was there, mm-hmm. and it was to make someone smile and feel good and to have just a lovely afternoon with people.
Was there a seminal moment, Rachel, in those early days where you really knew you were onto something and were making a difference?
You know, it's interesting. Usually that those moments become through a challenge,
mm-hmm.
and the beginning of those moments start pretty daunting or negative, and then the ending is, you know, you see why you do it, so it's important that you follow through, and that's what I always love to tell my volunteers now, because, you know, my moment is one of the very first makeovers that I had. I went in, you know, we had the group there, and the ladies were sitting at their seats, and I went over to a woman, and she wasn't smiling. She was very quiet.
Mm-hmm.
I even checked with the activities director. Do you want me to converse with this person? She's like, yeah, go. So I think the bouncy, energetic teenager I was, I danced circles around her. I offered her the lipstick, the blush, and, you know, she said hardly anything, but she didn't move. She seemed to be, you know, just quiet about it. And after almost 2 hours of being with this person, I left the makeover thinking to myself, wow, maybe this organization or what I'm building doesn't really impact people, because I guess the instant gratification of being a teenager wasn't met.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Where's my smile?
Yeah, where's my smile? And at dinner that night, I actually received a call from the activities director, who I immediately thought, I'm in trouble. Like, I'm not answering the phone. And, you know, she was double checking about, you know, you had seen Faye today, right? And I said, yes. You know, she was very quiet. She didn't smile. And she's like, that's why I'm calling. And she shared that Faye had been severely depressed, mm-hmm. had stopped eating, and said she started eating again after. And I think if I never got that call, I would have maybe even stopped doing what I was doing.
Yeah.
But for me, that really struck home, because, you know, my grandmother went through the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think many people do. Actually, I was just speaking to a professor who's studying ageism, mm-hmm. at Stevens Institute of Technology, Dr. Little, and she shared that on average, most seniors are happy people, happier mm-hmm. than most generations.
That's right.
So hearing that was like, you know, this is something that's institutional in our communities we need to address.
Mm-hmm.
And the senior population is going to be the oldest it's ever been in the next 20 years. Our population is going to be the oldest. And there is huge discussions about around quality of life, policy, you know, social economic decision making that has to happen with the aging generation. And so it's important that young people can have a dialogue.
That's a beautiful story. Well, walk us through this process. How do you enlist these young people to become volunteers? And then how do you connect with more than that, just one senior home, but a lot of senior homes, to get this thing going? So tell us about how that works.
So in the beginning, I have to say, the good old-fashioned press was a huge driver for interest. You know, we were in every teen magazine, and we would get calls and emails, and we would grow our base that way. Now, with social media, and after 19 years of service, we have people, younger cousins, mm-hmm. my friend from another school. Somebody texted me, this is what I have to do in life.
Yeah.
My mom told me, my great aunt told me, you know.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth mm-hmm. is really viral still. It's still a really strong indicator. So we have all the technology tools to guide people toward the resources to get involved. So we have our website, of course, which is the first place you hit. It's sort of our storefront, if you want to call it, and you can see how, you know, you can get involved. And we used technology in a way to grow. So from those 2 volunteers to almost 2,000 around the country,
mm-hmm.
we found that as a small, when it was just a volunteer of one managing things and then growing a staff, using technology to be able to communicate with large groups in an efficient manner is what. So we have an onboarding online chapter system that the volunteers register in. They receive notifications. They create a chapter online that has a host of tools and resources that keep them going, because, you know, if volunteering was easy, everybody would do it. But you need that sort of older sister there cheering you on in your service.
How many chapters do you have now, and how many states are you in?
We serve about 100 communities.
Mm-hmm.
And I say communities because a chapter can be made up of For example, in rural Ohio, four high schools coming together serving one senior home. Or in Staten Island, we have one high school visiting four senior homes. So it's really interesting how the students and the demand or the need in the community is how the chapter is built. So we give that flexibility in the structure that we provide.
And what happens when the volunteers go to a senior home? How long are they there? What do they do? How frequently do they come?
Do you have 5 hours to explain the variations? You know, what's great about how we build this organization is that we give a framework for leadership positions so students can really own their chapters and bring their own ideas and creativity to it. So what we might start with is a little bit of the gimmick of the makeup to say, here's an easy way to introduce yourself. If you have nothing else to talk about, you say, what color lipstick would you like? Would you like us to paint your nails today?
Conversation starter.
It's just the starter.
Yeah.
And then from there, the students say, well, now that you look great and you feel good and we're talking, let's stay for tea. Let's, you know, play the Wii game together. Let's plan a senior prom together. And we have what we call a chapter creativity fund where students in their journals can reflect and share their ideas. And a lot of those ideas, when they're shared with us, we can sort of economies of scale, bring them out to the other chapters and share them among the network of chapters. And we also provide resources for them to do it. Because as a high school student, you know, you might not have disposable income to you know, buy those extra things that keep you at the senior home, not just 1 or 2 hours, 3 hours longer or on a consistent basis. So I look at it as the framework that we provide as an organization is a springboard for all the other incredible things that those individuals bring to the chapter.
It becomes very organic. You know, it's been said, Rachel, that you've never really managed until you've managed volunteers. And you've managed a lot of volunteers or somewhat of an expert in the subject. What are the keys to doing that effectively?
You know, I've always believed in positive leadership. I think that you, when you're not paying people, you can't rule as a dictator. And I see it so many times in business. I've had great conversations with my husband about, you know, the bosses we've had in the past and things like that, where I said, you know, in bad times, those people are the first ones to the chopping block, because, you know, negativity and not finding how to inspire and tap into the talents of your existing pool of people that you work with, that's sustainable leadership.
It's intrinsic.
It's intrinsic
motivation they have, as opposed to extrinsic being forced upon them.
Exactly. And I find that our mantra for our volunteers, or even internally with our staff or our interns or anyone involved in our network, is tapping into and finding what's relevant to them and finding why they're there. And when you can find out the why of an individual, in, of course, in a process that makes sense for your organization, you know, they're invested in it and they have ownership in it. And in all different levels and ways, to be able to tap into that is what creates sustainable leadership.
You know, we talked about Faye before, but talking more broadly, when women get made up like this, they have this deep connection with a volunteer. How does her behavior change in that senior center?
Well, we say women, but we have plenty of men who come to the makeovers. It's a popular thing to come into a room of young people chatting with older people, although women do outnumber men 8-to-1 in most senior facilities, so we can broadly say women. You know, it's, I think at any age, when someone spends their most valuable resource, their time, with you and says, you're worth my time, and not only that, I'm going to make you feel good physically by touch, embrace, you know, and then reflect on it with you together, I think it's anybody would feel good after that. And we just, we do an annual senior home survey each year, and 100% of anybody we've ever get a response from, in terms of activities director, president of the senior home, sometimes a mother, a daughter of a mother who's in a senior home, they say, you know, 100% say their mood has changed for the better, and they long and wait for the next time the students come back.
Yeah, that's great. You know, as nice as it is having the students there, sometimes the anticipation of them coming is just as good. You know, they're looking forward
they're
to
looking
it.
They're looking forward to it.
Yeah, there's an event. There's an activity.
You know, they say loneliness or isolation is as bad as smoking 16 cigarettes a day.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's sort of a secret it's a secret issue because, you know, it's not seen, you know, like smoking, you see it on the streets or something, but, you know, with
it's
loneliness,
like mental health or
isolation.
Something like that. You
mental
know, we
health.
Just don't talk, you can't see it, so it doesn't exist in a
exactly.
lot of people's mind. That's exactly,
exactly.
right. And these thousands and thousands of volunteers that you've had, they keep reflective journals from, you know, the people that they visited as being part of Glamour Gal. Share with us some of their thoughts and reflections.
Well, we read them every day.
Uh-huh.
I think it's important for us as an organization who's spread throughout the country to have a barometer of, like, what's happening in North Carolina or, you know, Southern California, and we're in New York. So when you're able to read, you know, sometimes real experiences that happen to teens in the senior homes, you as an organization can remain agile and see that. But we had a professor at Yale read over our scholarship essay applications and some of the journals, and she found that there is a deep transformation that happens within students. And even our last year's volunteer survey shared that 89% of our volunteers share that the experience with Glamour Gals informs their future mm-hmm. careers and academic decisions, as well as 50% of them said they were interested in careers in STEM.
I know. You have so many. Why that correlation, do you think?
You know, I know that with our college chapters, many of them are pre-med students.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important, well, to deal with seniors, and it's this idea of sort of bedside manner maybe in the future as a doctor. You know, you have to interact with people who have illnesses or things that are happening to them that they can't control, and being able to relate to, you know, patients in the future.
And another thing you do with these young people is you have a leadership training program.
We do.
What is that, the focus of that?
You know, we found that there's this incredible exchange between the different generations. You have the seniors who are feeling dignified and having companionship and being able to share their stories and life advice. And then the students sort of digest all of that. And we give them the platform to take this experience and reflect on it through our journals. They can earn intergenerational service awards that can work towards scholarships, LinkedIn recommendations, recommendations for college, as well as we have a relationship with St. Peter's University,
mm-hmm.
a presidential full ride scholarship reserved for students who have academically achieved as well as achieved a certain number of service hours in journals with Glamour Gals. And I think what's really unique about how we approach leadership is this idea that it's based in service.
Mm-hmm.
It's an experiential leadership program. And all along the way, we're using the tools of technology and outreach. We constantly share the opportunities to foster being an empathetic leader within this.
Yeah, it's compassionate leadership. Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. And how does that fit, you think, in the whole leadership framework these days? Because it's becoming, you're really on the cutting edge of that. And it's becoming, seems to me, more and more popular and important and critical in terms of leading organizations.
You know, a couple of years ago, we were hosting our, like, 13th annual leadership training that we host every Saturday before Thanksgiving in New York City with upwards of 200 volunteers. We stream it live to our volunteers who can, like, watch it with hot cocoa in bed
mm-hmm.
and somewhere else. It was like a week or two after the Paris attacks.
Uh-huh.
And I said, this, and many people might say, oh, I don't want my son or daughter going into New York City. It's a big city. Something could happen. And I say, more than ever, this type of conference that allows young people to reflect in the way they do and hear and be inspired by leaders and entrepreneurs and people and professionals who can share how important it is to be an empathetic decision maker as a future leader or business person or teacher, whoever they become, is so critical.
Yeah.
And I think we just need more of that.
Yeah.
And we need our leaders to be that way.
Yeah, it is a critical skill to have in the 21st century. There's no question about it. You're a nonprofit, but you're also a business. So how do you operate and where do you get your financial support from?
I think my professors would be proud when I say diversified revenue
oh,
streams.
Oh, there you go.
You
many, many
it,
streams.
if you name it, we've tried it, you know? And I think...
What works the best?
I think it depends on the year and time. You have mm-hmm. to just... You have to look at your budget and plan for it. I think I'm really lucky to have council and board members who see, you know, we have their critical donations happen in the first quarter. So it's, you know, we keep the lights on by saying, you know, we know that we have this base of donors who are willing to see the long-term vision in our organization and say, I'm going to make my donation in first quarter so we can always plan for that. And from there, open up their networks. You know, we have our executive council that I call it the Choose Your Own Adventure Council, because these people, you know, they've tapped into what really interest them in the organization, and then maybe they don't always have the time, but they have the resources or the network to share, and they do share it, which is great. So, you know, it's everything from program revenue when you can, because a lot of times as we grow, we're growing into neighborhoods that need these resources and need us, but don't have the ability to pay that $100 registration fee. Yeah. And I've never wanted money to be a reason why a girl doesn't attend one of our leadership training. So we sometimes charge $5 to come, or they get sponsored.
Mm-hmm.
I know growing up, I had opportunities that were presented to me, and my parents said, I'm sorry, like, we can't do that.
Yeah.
And you miss out on being inspired by some incredible people. So I never want a financial burden to be why somebody cannot participate in our program. So, you know, I think that we brought on some really great corporate sponsors as well. Like, this past year, we've been focusing on building that out. And I spoke at an HSBC conference before, and my executive council member invited me to have a dialogue actually about how all the different ways, the suite of ways corporations can get involved. And a lot of times it starts with just saying, here's the person you contact in the office to get involved, because most employees don't even know that. It's just such simple things as an email
blast. Remove the friction.
Remove it. Just say, here's the contact person. And it can start with 5 employees or 200.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times you're so professionals are so busy, they think, oh, I have to do this one day a year with 1,000 employees, where really, for nonprofits, it's better to have that consistency, a couple employees each month engaging with the nonprofit, because somebody who has 3 staff, you know, we can't, 1,000 volunteers, that's great. Once, it sort of doesn't necessarily serve the nonprofit always.
Not at all. So the business model is whatever it takes.
You got it.
You know, with all the wonderful work and the impact the organization has, I'm sure you're faced with a lot of challenges in addition to what you just mentioned. What's your biggest challenge right now?
You know, I think we're going through an interesting growth period where for the past 15 years, we've built a suite of really rich, incredible leadership, critical events in New York City, where the base of 50% of our volunteer chapters are. And we want to be able to preserve that quality that we've built over the past 15 years and still address the demand for probably upwards of our new chapter demand coming in is majority of them are outside of New York City. So as a nonprofit, we're trying to balance and say we need to find the funding to sustain the leadership development program that we've supported our local volunteers with, as well as then the resources for chapter engagement outside of the New York City area. Mm-hmm. And because we have like a chapter process that doesn't start really when they're volunteering. It's all the things you have to do to get to your first makeover or your first meeting. And that's finding your chapter leader, scheduling with the senior home, getting approved by your school. And our staff walks the volunteers through that every step of the way. So we have a chapter process that it begins with that phone call, that text, that email, and then might take 1 month or 3 months to get the chapter started.
You know, let me close with this, Rachel. As you look back over these past 20 years, there is so much to be grateful for and so much to be proud of. In terms of gratitude, who would be the person that you would be most grateful for? And in terms of pride, what are you most proud of?
I would say I'm most proud of the volunteer that I've never met. When you create an organization, especially at such a young age, I got a lot of press around it, and it was like Rachel's thing. And as it continued to grow, it was I found that the story was much larger than me, because people would email me. I have hundreds and almost probably 1,000 emails from people around the world sharing how this means something to them or their family. So I'm most proud of the volunteer that I've never met in Wisconsin or Texas or Chicago, you know, all these places, that is inspired by the mission and about their work and not by me. And I think that is, as a leader, to have something that's bigger than yourself and that can live on and be successful without you is the biggest thing I could be proud of. And then the other thing is, of course, I think I'm just really lucky to have such an incredibly supportive family.
Yeah.
We were joking before about the idea that, you know, my first board meeting was at the dinner table and it was like, pass the string beans, ended up in the notes, you know? We take very copious notes, you know? You know, and the lawyer was like, who's Alan? You know, that's my dad. He was at the dinner table. Well, he's not part of the board. Well, you know, he was at the dinner table. So, you know, I think that I'm really lucky to have a supportive family who have always fostered my crazy creative ideas that I had and allowed me to explore them and in any way support me to do them. And I want to pay that forward now to the volunteers that I serve and the women that we serve in any way that I can.
Well, Rachel Doyle, the founder and CEO of Glamour Gals, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website and what visitors will find there.
GlamourGals.org. You can also find us on social media, on Instagram, @_GlamourGals, or mm-hmm. Twitter, GlamourGals. Just Google Glamour Gals Foundation, and you'll get us. But there's a great, there's actually a 4-minute video right on the homepage of our website. I encourage everybody to take a little coffee break today and be inspired by all the incredible people in our organization.
Well, thanks, Rachel. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be Dan Porterfield, the president and CEO of the Aspen Institute. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and do return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.